Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, we get to have Itamar Zuhr. He is the co-founder and CEO of Veo. Ita, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me on the show, Jess. I'm excited for it.
Yeah. So, why don't we start with people who don't know what you guys do. How do you explain it?
So Veo is a next generation shipping. Think about it this way. We work with e-commerce companies to help them deliver their packages to consumer doors and do it in a way that customers fall in love with the brand they receive the box from. So the way this works is if somebody places an order online, Veo picks up those boxes from the warehouse of the company that customer bought from and facilitates the delivery all the way to the customer door. And when a customer receives the box, they can control their delivery. They can reroute the package to a different address. They can reschedule their delivery. We provide a seamless experience that makes the customer feel that they're in control. And because of that, because customers feel that they're in control, they like and appreciate the brand more, and they tend to come back and buy more from that brand. So ultimately, you know, we're reinventing shipping, and we're helping e-commerce companies build deeper loyalty with our customers so the customers come back and buy more from us. So it's a win-win for everybody.
There's so much money in removing friction, isn't there?
You know, I think that is a lot of the common theme among many of the innovators in our space. I heard an interview with the chief revenue officer of Flexport at the time, which is another company in logistics and technology. And he was saying that if there's a common denominator for many of the companies nowadays, and many of the innovators, it is those are companies that go and take industries where the net promoter score, NPS, is low, and they create a higher net promoter score. And it comes down to removing friction, just making things easier, seamless. And that opens up an array of possibilities when the customers, you know, ultimately love the product. So yeah, in essence, that's what we do.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, I was poking around a little bit. I saw like one of your rounds you guys had raised, I think, $170 million. Do you disclose what your total fundraise is or your last valuation?
Yeah, we raised over $300 million in total. And our investors were lucky to have some of the top growth growth fund investors in the world. Our last valuation from early 2022 was about $1.6 billion post money.
Yeah, that's great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about that. For all the founders today or all the fund managers who are coaching their CEOs that they've invested in, what's a billion-dollar success secret that you could have only learned by actually doing the work you've done?
Oh, man. You know, the first thing I'm thinking about is just being obsessed about the problem that you're trying to solve. And, you know, I'm not here to tell people how to build billion-dollar companies necessarily, but the one thing that has been I think true for us is that you have to be relentless about, you know, what problem you're solving and who you're solving the problem for. And I think there, when one is building a company, and certainly when there's a lot of money that is being raised, it is very easy to get distracted with a million opportunities that will come along the way. I get approached all the times by other companies that want to do all kinds of partnerships, and just being very loyal to who you're trying to solve the problem for. So for us, what this means is, we want to solve the problem for the end customer and for the brands that serve that end customer. When you're receiving a box, Jess, and let me ask you a question. Have you ever had a bad delivery experience?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, right? They, so you have, go ahead.
Well, at this place, they keep like, at our office building, they keep like delivering packages to somebody else's door and sending the picture and telling us it was delivered. Like, that's not our door. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I get that you delivered it. You just didn't deliver it to us.
It happens all the time, right? The reason I started this business, and we may go into the funding story, you know, a little later, is that I could not get stuff delivered to my own door. I would walk into my building and there would be sticky notes on the front door of the glass door of the building from UPS and FedEx. And it said, you know, sorry, we missed you. It was just a bad experience across the board. I think, you know, any person you ask nowadays if they've had a bad delivery experience will say yes and give you some examples. As you start growing the business, to answer your question, a lot of other opportunities come along the way. You can do all kinds of partnerships. We can work with all kinds of companies. But remaining loyal to that problem, how do we create an incredible delivery experience that removes the friction and that allows us to help customers feel more connected to the brands and come back and buy again? is the secret, because they continue to obsess about that problem. They continue to understand what else can we be solving? What's not working right now? Where is that friction? And I think one of the success secrets, if you will, of building a billion-dollar business is that at any point in time, the company has to obsess about one thing that matters. So for us, it's the customer. And the way we measure that with the customer is our on-time delivery rate, which is what percentage of packages actually were delivered within the time that we promised. We have over 99% on-time delivery. It's the highest in the country. And the average customer rating, how do customers rate us? For us, it's 4.9 stars out of 5, which is higher than any other company in our space. And obsess over this no matter what. Don't let anybody distract you.
Makes me think about when Jeff Bezos bought Zappos for over $1 billion and said, I get weak in the knees when I see a customer-obsessed company.
Exactly. And there's a lot of learnings from Jeff Bezos. I'll give you one example. You know, there's this book, The Amazon, The Everything Store. Have you read it? I highly recommend it.
I own it. I've started it.
Oh, okay. Great. So, you know, in the Everything Store, he talks about how Jeff Bezos, you know, when he gets an email from an angry customer, he acts on it right away. And that email gets sent in the company and there's people who jump over it right away. I think it sends a very strong message, which is this company obsesses about customer experience. And we're not going to be, you know, loose about how customers see us. And every customer matters. Every package matters. And it's a notion that, you know, we brought from Amazon into Veo, that even though you're growing into millions of packages and millions of deliveries and so many things that could go wrong along the way, if you're not putting that customer in the center, particularly when the customer reaches out to the CEO, but in any other channel as well, then you're starting to lose your edge. That's the obsession. That's the culture of obsessing over the customer experience that has brought Amazon to where it is. And, you know, we're to a very large extent, we're also doing the same thing.
That's so great. I am, you know, I had the benefit of interviewing the founder of Zoom pre-COVID, long before anybody realized what Zoom was going to become. And I think it was, I want to say he's like in my first 30 interviews I ever did, you know, 900 interviews ago, right? And I was shocked at his level of customer obsession. He, you know, spent years at Cisco, and was annoyed that their service just wasn't reliable enough and wasn't good enough. And so he built his own, right? And he got his first 140,000 customers with no advertising, purely like NPS score style acquisition, okay? And like, he was telling me like, and this is, and he has like so many customers. When somebody would email in to cancel their membership, he got a notification. And so he would write them right then and say, hey, I'm the CEO of the company. I'm so sorry to see you go. Wish we, you know, hope you'll come back someday. Would love to know if there's anything we could have done better. And the people write back like, haha, this is a funny bot. I know this is not the CEO. And he's like, no, I am right now. Can we hop on a Zoom? I would love to know what we could have done to have, you could have done better for you. People hop on a Zoom with him right then. He's like getting on these live Zooms with all these people canceling. They're just like beyond impressed. Give him a second chance. And it was just like, at a level I'd never met anyone like that before. So I was not surprised when he won COVID because of what he was like, you know, years before COVID had started.
Exactly. And back to your question, you know, what's the secret? The secret is you got to obsess over the customer. And as CEOs, as founders, our job is not only to do this ourselves, but also to set an example for everybody else. If the CEO of Zoom, with all his busy schedule, makes the time to jump on the call with the customer in real time, that sets an example for everybody else. That's what matters for the organization. With Veo, I can give you an example. Customers sometimes reach out to me on Facebook. So somehow they find my Facebook account, and they send me a message, and I'm sitting in the middle of a meeting, I'm getting a Facebook message from a customer, and they're saying, whatever they say, they had a bad experience. And you know, when you deliver millions of boxes, every now and then something goes wrong. The question is, what do you do about it? Do you continue to prioritize the other things, or do you prioritize the customer in real time? And we built a whole system that allows me to then channel this to another person and at the same time answer the customer and ask more information and make sure that they feel heard and make sure that even if it's on Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter or whatever they find, they're going to get an answer from the CEO because they matter to us that much. And I think that is the kind of culture that creates incredible companies over time, as with the Zoom and the Amazon example.
Yeah. What's another billion-dollar success secret?
So if we go to, you know, taking a step back from just business for a minute, you know, I have been reflecting a lot about what has helped me grow in my role as CEO. You know, every founder starts a company and day one, you are doing everything on your own. I was driving all the routes myself. I was sorting all the packages, doing all the sales. I sold the first $50 million with the deck, just myself, no salesperson in the company. And then over time, you know, the role evolves. There's more people, strategy changes. How does one grow and keep up with this? And how does one keep up with the mental ups and downs? You know, there's a famous concept among founders, the roller coaster of entrepreneurship. I'm sure you've heard this before many times, and maybe you've gone through one of those. How do you stay resilient? And the secret, in my view, to building something large, and just to be very clear, it's not like we're saying Vio is larger than we feel good about it. I still think about it as a company that is on its day one, just like with Amazon. We're only at the beginning of the journey, and you know, there's an opportunity for us to really change the way consumers shop from e-commerce brands and really power the future of commerce. You know, but you know, we've been on a journey for a while, and we've had some success, and we're proud of it. And you know, on a personal level, the ability to build mental resilience, I think, is one of the key secrets for success, because that's the thing that sort of like guarantees that no matter what happens in the world, market change, funding is available and one day it's not available, client churns, something happens, some you know, top employee leaves the company. You know, we continue to stay focused and feel good about what we do and get the thing done every single day, and we don't let that distract us. And, you know, I wrote this down. It's easy to say mental resilience, but what are the practices on a day-to-day basis that help founders build mental resilience? And I'm sure this applies to, you know, every other profession we have to provide, to perform at your peak level. Professional athletes and, you know, actors, actresses, and CEOs, politicians, etc. So, you know, it comes down to essentially building an operating system, a personal operating system that allows me to continue building myself and staying level-headed all the time. I meditate every morning. Sleep is sacred. I work out a lot. I take time to reflect and write down my reflections. You know, I spend time with people that I trust, and so I can share and I can be open and vulnerable with and get some input from. I think all those things matter. And during times when all I was doing was working, and I was not taking time to take care of myself, I wasn't working out, I wasn't sleeping enough, I wasn't meditating because, you know, it wasn't important enough, then that's where things start to go sideways. Personally, I start to feel that I'm not doing the best job. It trickled to the company. The strategy wasn't clear. People weren't feeling the motivation. And people look after you as CEO. People take the energy. If you're positive, if you're excited, they're going to be excited. And I think that's one of the biggest secrets for success that are not spoken enough of, which is managing one's psyche to stay focused despite everything that is going on in the world.
Can we talk about the reflections?
Please.
This is something so interesting to me. I bring it up on the show a decent amount, like, because I've had, you know, over the years, I have these investors who built their companies into the tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions, tens of billions, right? And for me, so often, people are always asking, okay, the guys who built the biggest companies, the women that manage the most money in their funds or things like this, right? What's different about them? And a couple of things that I've noticed a lot is like this humble listening, where they're really listening for disconfirming evidence about, you know, they're looking for the friction. They're looking for what's not working, right? Instead of listening for how great they are. Observing, you know, hey, the customer said this, the staff said this, but what do I see? Whether that's data, whether that's physically observing them, just like observing what's different than what they're hearing. And then thinking harder, like going away from everybody and like, you know, connecting the dots that weren't connected and like really pushing themselves on thinking harder, instead of just being reactive or something. Like, I don't know how to put it into great words. I should work hard on this, but like, there is this like common trait of like time set aside for deep reflection. And it's so much more efficient than working harder. You know, they find these like these tiny little things that have these exponential differences, you know, the hinge that swings the whole door, right? For your thinking about your reflections, is this pen and paper? Do you do it digitally? What time of day do you do it?
I go out on long walks, actually. And that's one of the things that I learned during COVID. You know, companies started to grow really fast during COVID. And a little bit of context, and I'll go back to talk about reflections, is that we were fundraising our seed round in 2020. It was right at the beginning of the pandemic. And as we closed the round, e-commerce started to boom. It was growing very fast before the pandemic. We all know that. But during the pandemic, you know, really, when you can't go and buy anything online at the physical store, people start to buy a lot online. And FedEx and UPS, who we compete with, could not take more volume. Their capacity was fixed. They couldn't, you know, they just didn't have more rooms in the car. VO has a flexible fleet of driver partners. It's like, it's crowdsourced. It's an app. We could grow our capacity really quickly. So I find myself running a company remotely where we're growing 50x or 100x a year. And I did not get up from my chair. I was working nonstop, and I slept maybe 5 hours a night. And that's, by the way, I did not have gray hair when I started VO. It wasn't too long ago. It was 8 years ago, and now I do. It's because of those 2 years. And I wasn't stopping to think about, are we focusing on the right things? Are we really bringing in the right people? You know, how do we go from here? There was a point in time when I started not to feel well, physically well. And I said to myself, I have to take a step back and invest in my health. And that's when I started to not only meditate, but also go out on long walks every day. Just go out for a walk, listen to music, I listen to meditation music, I listen to dance music, whatever that is. And what's interesting about how the brain works, I'm not a scientist by any means, but what I've noticed is that the brain is able to do a lot of the calculation when you let it rest a little bit. The best ideas come when you're not thinking about things. You know, people say that the best ideas come in the shower or, you know, I was just going to a basketball NBA game on Saturday and I was sitting there watching the game. I love basketball and all these great ideas came to me. And I find myself like, you know, writing down on my phone all these ideas that came when I was not supposed to be thinking about those ideas. So that's essentially the practice. You know, what I found is that I cannot force reflection. I can't say now I'm sitting down doing all the reflection. That's really hard to do. Because that does not guarantee that the best ideas and the insights and the connections are going to rise up in the brain. Instead, I'm giving myself time to do other things and not activities that require a lot of thinking, but activities that, you know, essentially give the brain time to rest. And that's when ideas start coming. And then I go back home and I sit down with those ideas and then I start flashing them out on a piece of paper. I have a whiteboard in my living room. I know it's a little weird, but everybody has their thing, you know, and that's how I do it.
You know, there's, I love this story that what you're laying out for us. If you really like this, there's a book you might like called Autopilot by Andrew Smart. And do you know this book?
I've heard of it, but please tell me.
So, it's basically the science that proves everything you're saying. They were measuring these people's brains. I want to say in MRI machines for brain activity and say, well, what part of the brain lights up when they think about this? What part of the brain lights up when they think of that? And they told them, okay, don't think about anything. We got to do some calculations. And the machine would light up. And they're like, hey, we need you to be calm. Can we do this thing? You know, what are you thinking about right now? And like, I'm not thinking about anything. And they accidentally discovered this thing called the default mode network. And essentially, they proved the science of when your brain isn't as engaged in conscious activity, that this other part of your brain lights up and starts to process and connect dots and put things together. Like to your point of like, why do we all have such good ideas in the shower? Right. And you know, why is it that, you know, sleeping on it is such a good idea? Right. I mean, there's countless stories about people being on a long walk and coming up with their idea, or, you know, Newton in the bathtub and the apple, or, you know, Pythagoras. Yeah. Anyway, there's so many of these stories of like these people who come up with like the eureka moment when the guy jumps out of the bathtub, right? It wasn't when he was sitting at his desk and scheduled time for reflection. And so anyways, it's the science behind exactly what you just described. And I wonder if you'd enjoy it.
I'd love to read a book. Thanks. I actually wrote down the note here. And you know, as it relates to reflections, I'll tell you one more reflection, if that's okay. Along the way, you know, again, as founder, one has to do everything. You know, you're the salesperson. You go and deliver the packages. You build the product. You raise the money. But over time, and I think part of the secrets for success to building a successful company is to surround yourself with people who are better than you at certain things, and essentially fire yourself from jobs that somebody else can do it better. And but what is the job of the CEO? Then, you know, there are philosophies around, well, making sure that the company has enough money and selling in the vision. Those things are true, but I think every CEO ultimately scales themselves the most when they focus on their gifts, their strengths, the areas that are, you know, they're naturally great at. That's how you provide the most value for the company. And many of the companies, especially founder-led companies, are companies that were designed around that strength of the CEO, the founder at least, or the co-founder. For me, the reflection is that creativity is something that actually provides a lot of value to the company. Thinking creatively about what can we solve and how can we do it in a different way and how can we talk about it in a different way, how can we market ourselves in a different way, etc. And to the point about giving the brain time for reflection, creativity cannot be managed into a specific time slot on the calendar. It's not like you can say today between 2 to 3 p.m., I'm going to be creative. And the brain doesn't work this way, at least not my brain. And so thinking through how can you manage your calendar, your time, in a way that gives you enough time to get creative, to let everything you talked about in the book autopilot, right? Let the math happen in the back of the brain so that the creativity can come out. You know, I think that's been a huge takeaway, that I have to make time in my calendar to do nothing. And I have to free up my weekends, not work on the weekends, even though there's always more things to do. Because that's when the best ideas come. That's where the best reflections come. And those are the game changers for the company moving forward.
You know, one of my favorite business books of all time is the billionaire Richard Koch, the 80-20 principle. And, you know, I'd read the book maybe 20 times and then I got to have him on the show. And it was so fun. But he talks so often about, so he sold LEK after BCG and Bain, he sold LEK. I would say he got like 5 million and he grew that into 1.4 billion working like a couple hours a day, an hour a day. And he talks about how like busy people often don't have enough time to think hard enough. And he just like really extols the virtues of a bike ride with his dog, you know, long walks, having unscheduled time. And that this idea of like the only way to financial success is hard work. He's kind of like living proof that that's not the only way. And that superior ideas can actually do it. Through efficiencies. I want to shift gears though. You know, you guys are having so much success and you're there in New York, but we've had a lot of great Israeli entrepreneurs on here over the years. I'd love to hear a lesson from your time in the IDF that you feel like has helped you in your career and specifically as a founder.
One of the things that I think are unique to the IDF, and just to be clear, I never served in any other military. So it's not like I can go and compare this to other militaries, but knowing the Israeli culture and now having lived in the US for close to 9 years, you know, I will allow myself to make some comparison. For better or worse, in the Israeli military, the concept of, you know, deferring to somebody with a higher title is not really a thing that people really abide by. And that's not to say that there aren't ranks. There are ranks and there are commands and you got to do those things. But the concept, the notion that you cannot challenge your superior does not exist in the military. And if anything, the opposite is encouraged, being able to talk openly and anybody can share ideas and anybody can push back and challenge is something that is very, very encouraged. When I started Veho, I wrote down the values before I even knew what the company was going to do. And I was thinking through what are going to be the values that are going to promote the best work culture. And one of the values that I had was, we've changed this along the way, but at least in the beginning, really was really important to me is, you know, everybody has a say. That's not to say that everybody gets to decide because you can't have, a democracy or consensus around every decision in business. Sometimes you just have to decide and move forward. But how do we create a workplace where people feel empowered to speak up? and challenge their superiors and challenge anybody around them if they think differently. If one person says, this is what we're going to do, and everybody just says yes, and they go in the wrong direction, then that's not the best way to run the company. You got to figure out how to, you know, use everybody's brain around you. I think that's one of the biggest takeaways from the Israeli military. And if it works in the military, just where you need people to follow suit and follow orders, it certainly works in business.
Yeah, you know, my consulting firm and the one I worked at before I started mine had lots of Department of Defense clients, U.S. military. And certainly in the big army, it's much more common that it's like, you know, the colonel gets the brain and the other 3,000 of you do the work, right? Or, you know, those jokes about if we'd wanted you to have a brain, they'd issued you one at in basic training, right?
Yeah.
But in special operations, it's very often the upside down pyramid. And the more elite, like the classified units, it's even more drastically that. And to me, it's not surprising that those guys can get done things that others can't and timeframes that are astronomically faster, you know?
You know, I have several friends who serve in elite units or fighter pilots who are typically folks who have very high IQ and a lot of opportunities around them. And it's a conversation that I always had with them. You know, to what extent do you feel that you can influence decision-making, even if you're not the person who's making the final decision? And I was asking them, how do you feel comfortable following somebody else's orders and go to a combat, you know, zone when you don't have all the information? Do you feel not empowered? Do you not scared? And what's interesting is that the consensus, and I heard this again, was quite the opposite, is because we built the culture that I have full trust in the people above me. I can participate in that discussion. I can challenge them. They hear me out. I have more confidence that we're making the right decision. I'm more bought in to do the things. And sometimes those things are risking one's lives because you were able to build that culture. And I will tell you, you know, even with VO, as companies are going through ups and downs, and certainly the past 3 years, there were a lot of changes in the world from a macroeconomic standpoint. Being able to share the strategy, being transparent about this, and welcome people to ask questions and challenge is so important to get the buy-in so everybody continues to march in the same direction. And I brought that from the Israeli culture. It's not foreign to the U.S., but it's very prevalent in the U.S., in the Israeli military and the IDF.
Yeah. Well, listen, I know it was 6 months ago now, but our heart goes out to your country for the horrible terrorist attack there. And I know there's a lot of hurt to overcome and the situation isn't figured out. But I mean, that's one thing we can agree on is that those are actions that shouldn't be happening in this world. So.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I want to get that out there. You know, as we look at all these different things that you've done, well, let's start with this. If people want to follow you online, is LinkedIn the best place? If they want to find out about your services, what's the website?
Yes. LinkedIn is probably the best place. I don't post often. I mostly focus on running the business and serving my own people and our customers and clients. Every now and then I post on LinkedIn and I always welcome comments and engaging in comments. So that's a place on a personal level. For the company, shipvho.com is the best place to see what we do, and also we're quite active on LinkedIn and social media in general.
That's great. Well, as we kind of wrap up here, what's one of the best pieces of business advice you ever received?
Wow, we seem so many. Just, you know, just before we started, you know, this conversation today, I told you that, you know, I had my own podcast about entrepreneurship, and I had the front seat in asking founders of successful companies about the success story of their businesses. And so there's a very long list of tips that I got, and I actually wrote down when I started VO, I implemented some of those things. And I'll touch on one that just like jumps to mind now. This was the founder of, it was a serial entrepreneur of three companies, and they were successful in the hundreds of millions in terms of revenue, a couple of successful exits. He was also an F-16 pilot, fighter pilot in the IDF, and he was also an artist, a painter. And he told me a story that really resonated with me. The story was that he was taking a painting class, and he was starting to paint something. It looked like nothing. And, you know, the teacher walked by him, and the teacher was asking him, what are you painting? And he said, no, this is not going anywhere. And the teacher said, I think this is beautiful. Keep doing this. Keep doing what you're doing. And the point was, and then, you know, some beautiful thing comes out of it. The point was that sometimes when you're starting, it's not going to be pretty, and it's not really clear where you're going with this, but sometimes you just got to stay the course. And when you stay the course, good things happen. There's no guarantees, but if you are committed to the process, good things happen along the way. You know, when I started Veho, I started the company in 2016. We only started to grow really fast in 2020. It was during the pandemic. And there were 4 years where I was broke. I was living with my uncle, and I was like 35 when I moved in with my uncle because I couldn't pay rent. Where it was hard to keep employees because we didn't raise money, so it was hard to pay salaries, where everybody thought I was crazy, everybody thought Uber was going to do what we're doing, and whatever, you know, autonomous vehicles are going to disrupt our business. And having confidence that, you know, over the long run, this solution is going to be needed. Customers will need a better logistics solution, and e-commerce brands will need a better solution. And staying the course, keep on doing this every day, that grit, that I'm sure you've spoken with many entrepreneurs about, and understanding and acknowledging that it's not pretty today, but keep on doing this, keep iterating on this until you get to the right answer. I think that's one of the best things that we've done that allowed us to then stay in business when the pandemic happened and everything changed for us. And it's all started with the belief that what you're doing today is going to lead somewhere in the future. Just stay the course.
That's such great advice. You know, you think about entrepreneurship is so often an endurance sport, right?
That's why it is. At Veho, when we talk about culture and values, we bring a lot of examples from the professional sports realm, right? Because building mental resilience is a thing that we all need to do in life to be successful, but it's just very common for athletes because, you know, they see the success and failures in a very short timeline sometimes. If you're a basketball player, you're playing professional basketball every week. Every day, potentially, you see success and failure. How do you recover, and how do you keep yourself in the right mindset, and how do you endure over the long term? Because it's never just a sprint; it's a marathon, right? So that's what it's about.
Yeah, that's so great. Well, I appreciate you spending the time with us today. This has been really fun.
Jess, I enjoyed it. Thanks very much for having me here.
You bet. Okay, bye, everyone.